Open your Bible again this morning to Matthew chapter 5. I wonder of what country you are a citizen. Where does your citizenship lie? Chances are, if you had to prove it, you have something by which you could prove it. You have a passport, you have a birth certificate, a driver's license, some kind of paper, some kind of documentation by which you can show, you can prove, here I am a citizen of this country. The piece of paper, that document, validates your claim to citizenship. We have seen, as we began our series on the Sermon on the Mount, that Jesus has come to inaugurate what he calls the kingdom of heaven. It is his kingdom. So I ask, are you a citizen of Christ's kingdom? If you are a citizen of his kingdom, how can you prove it? You don't have a birth certificate that says, I was born a member of this, the kingdom of Christ. You don't have any kind of paper documentation. But as we saw, Jesus in the Beatitudes lays the groundwork for what he says his kingdom citizen will look like. This is how you can identify a kingdom citizen. We said that value number one in the kingdom of Christ is brokenness before God and humility before men. That is why he begins by saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The primary requirement for entrance to this kingdom that Christ is establishing is poverty of spirit, which we saw is the beginning of repentance and brokenness before God. We saw the connectedness of all the Beatitudes, how the one flows into the next, and we cannot separate them all. We saw that they are not personality types, but rather that they are all spiritual markers of what defines the heart of a Christian. Thus, it is not by a piece of paper, not by a date of some prayer that you prayed once upon a time, that you prove your citizenship in the kingdom of heaven. Rather, it is by the heart that you model, the way that you live, the characteristics of your life that are shown, that are displayed to all, that validate your claims to citizenship in the kingdom of heaven. Your citizenship is plain to all because value number one stands out so much from the world's values. Brokenness before God and humility before men leads to value number two of the kingdom. And value number two is where we want to spend our time this morning. And it's a natural result, the outflowing of the first. Value number two is standing out. It's being an outcast, being different than all the world around you, because you are a citizen of a different kingdom. Now, this is over against the world's value, the world's esteeming of fitting in, of just being like everyone else, of not making a scene. So, what we will do this morning is we will examine first the basis for our standing out. Secondly, we will look at the command itself. What exactly does it entail? How does Christ describe it? And thirdly, we will conclude with a call to choose. Now, adults, I suspect that it wouldn't take very long for you to sit and talk with any one of your children who are in school before you began to realize again just how incredibly immense the pressure is to conform, to fit in, to be like everyone else. Now, I have been amazed, and I don't know how long it is, 4 years, 5 years, since I have been out of high school, just how much this pressure has continued to increase. We live in a media-driven culture where everything is visual, and from the time kids are knee-high to a grasshopper, as they say, right up, they're exposed to much music and the like, where they learn that it is all about image. But I suppose that it probably would surprise many of us kids as well, to talk to our parents, to learn that this pressure is not exclusive to children. But rather, parents in the workplace face much of the same pressure, though perhaps it takes a little different form. There's the pressure to look good, the pressure to fit in around the water cooler, to have it all together in your personal life. It's the pressure to not rock the boat, to not have any values that are really different than anyone else, that's going to upset anyone else. To have the same perspective on homosexual rights and on abortion, roles of men and women, on stem cell research, on the raising of children. Don't have any different views, just sort of keep quiet about what you believe, because no one really wants the boat to be rocked, and really, the value is to conform, to fit in. But in stark and plain contrast to the values of the world, Christ says, if you follow me, if you claim to be a citizen of my kingdom, you will and you must stand out. And not only will you stand out, but he says you are blessed when you do. Now, this is not something just for super Christians, really. It's not an option that comes along with being a Christian. It's not like when you buy a car, you can get it with air conditioning or without air conditioning. When you become a Christian, this is the natural entailment. And as we have seen, all will stand out because all who follow Christ are poor in spirit. Are those who mourn over sin, are the meek, are the pure in heart. But we will be blessed when we do. Now, blessed does not mean just happy. These are not, as some have said, the be happy attitudes. This is not the key to having a successful, happy life that Jesus is laying down. Blessed, rather, means approved after testing. Thus, in the very word, we see it implied that there will come testing. In our study the last time, we got to the last beatitude and we noticed how Jesus used that. He said, Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. But then he uses that as a sort of launch pad to turn it around and change the direction of where he's going. He concludes the Beatitudes, but now he moves from the impersonal third person, they, blessed are they, and he turns around and says, you. He makes it personal. And this again implies all to whom I am speaking. He turns it on you because it is expected of you and it will happen. Again, as we saw, the blessing is for those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, not for being an idiot or for having a pet cause. This does not apply to someone who goes and blows up an abortion clinic and then gets sent to jail. That is justice, not persecution. Jesus is saying, blessed are you when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And we said righteousness in Matthean usage, particularly here in the Sermon on the Mount, applies or is defined rather as a life in conformity, a life patterned in conformity to the will of God. And as it is developed, it becomes a life patterned in conformity to Christ himself. Thus Jesus says, blessed are you when you are persecuted because you are modeling me. So if I'm going to stand out because I'm following someone, because I'm acting on what someone has told me or the pattern that someone has laid down for me, if I'm going to risk being the one that has to stand out and get made fun of at work or at school, I'm going to want to make sure that this person has their facts right, that this person is reliable, that this person is trustworthy. And so we examine, firstly, the basis for our standing out, the basis for our being different. Now, most of the world's bold people, if you will, the ones that really stand out, we say, wow, that person stands out. They must have a lot of self-confidence. They have placed confidence in themselves, in what they are or in what they think. But Christian standing out, for Christian being different is not in any way based on anything good that we see in ourselves, because we have seen that we are already poverty stricken in spirit. We know that we are sinful, so we act in faith and confidence in Christ and what He has said. Now, if I go to a friend, if I have a problem with my car, and I know that my friend knows nothing about cars, and I say, is there something wrong with my car? Pop the hood. So he pops the hood and starts fiddling around and doing all kinds of stuff, but he's never looked in a hood before, and he doesn't know what he's doing. And I say, okay, good enough. And I slam the hood, and off I go. My car explodes. I'm the idiot. Because I trusted one who didn't know what he was talking about. What we are suggesting is not a kind of blind faith, trusting one who doesn't know what he is talking about. But we can stand out in faith based on Christ's words, based on Christ's model, and know with certainty that I am right, even though the whole world is against me, even though the whole world says I am wrong, because I have it on Christ's authority. So what is Christ's authority? Firstly, let's look at it as it is developed in the Sermon on the Mount. In chapter 5 and verse 1, it begins this way: seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. That is significant because of a motif that has already been started in Matthew and runs through the whole course of Matthew. Now keep in mind, Matthew is writing his gospel to Jews who were very well versed in the Old Testament. And so he pictures Christ as coming and being one who goes up the mountain to give commands. What is that reminiscent of? He is beginning to be pictured as a new Moses. And that is immediately called to the mind of the original reader. So Christ is being pictured as a new Moses, but he goes on. When he went up the mountain and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. That might not be significant except for the fact that in our culture, when someone is teaching, the person who is teaching goes and stands up and everyone else sits down. But in that culture, the one who is teaching, as a symbol of the fact that they were about to go and teach, would go and sit. And then his disciples would come to him and realize that he is about to teach. He is about to proclaim with authority, "I am teacher, the one who is about to instruct you." So Jesus goes up the mountain as the new Moses and sits down as one with authority who is about to teach. And it goes on. He opened his mouth and taught them, saying, we can kind of tell, how is he going to teach if he doesn't open his mouth? But there is a purpose to what Matthew is saying here as well. This is a sort of formula that is developed through the Old Testament, that the prophet, when he is about to deliver an oracle from God, is the one who opens his mouth and speaks. And so Matthew says he's the new Moses, he's a teacher, but he is also a prophet coming to give these oracles from God, if you will. And then again in Matthew 5 and verse 17, he says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." He is the interpreter. He is the reissuer of the law. Throughout the rest of the chapter, he says, "You've heard that it was said to you, but I say to you," and claims an authority that is just solely because of his person, because of who he is. Thus, he is beginning to be pictured not only as a new Moses, but as a greater Moses. And this authority was not missed by the original audience. Thus, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 7 and verse 28 and verse 29, the crowds realize that Jesus is... this is one who is teaching with authority. Authority like we have never heard, like we have never seen. And immediately following the Sermon on the Mount, through the rest of Matthew, we see stories, again, of great miracles and wonders and signs that attest to the revelation and the authority of Christ. In chapter 12, Jesus declares, "I am greater than the temple." Again, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath, which... to the Old Testament, to one who is familiar with the Old Testament, immediately says, "Whoa, the Lord of the Sabbath is who? None other but God Himself." Then in chapter 17, the account of the Transfiguration, where Christ is lifted up, and alongside Christ are Moses and Elijah, and the voice of God thunders from heaven and says, "This is my Son." And what is the command that comes with that? Listen to Him. The audible voice of God the Father thundering from heaven, "Listen to my Son, because He is the one who delivers my words." Thus Christ is exalted over Moses, over Elijah. He is greater than all the law and the prophets. Christ, the Son of God, the partaker of the very character of God, who speaks the very words of God. The end of the gospel, He tells us before He returns to heaven that He has had all authority in heaven and earth given to Him. And now we are to go and teach others to obey His commands. That is the authority with which Christ commands us to stand out. And that is a sure basis for the command. It doesn't matter how the world thinks, and it doesn't matter what the world values. We act on what Christ has said, because He is the one who brings the revelation from God Himself. Having seen the basis for the command, we now want to examine the command itself. Stand out. How does Jesus develop that? How does He picture it? What exactly does the command entail? The command is not simply to stand out and to be persecuted as you stand out, but the command is to rejoice, to be glad when you do and when you are. Firstly, he gives two reasons. Firstly, because your reward is great in heaven. And he's given a hint of a theme that he's going to develop a little bit later, which is that the kingdom of Christ has entirely different currency. We don't live for the rewards and the values and the praise of this world, but for rewards that will come in heaven. But secondly, we rejoice and we are glad when we are persecuted for righteousness' sake, because we are treading, if you will, where the prophets have trod. We are following in the pattern that they have led down, or that they have laid down for us. It shows that you're on the right track. Likewise, Christ would develop this later and says, if the world hates you, remember that it hated me first. And if righteousness is living our lives in conformity to the pattern that Christ has laid down, we must remember that Christ, who was the ultimate display of righteousness, the world could not stand to the point that they put Him to death. We can't handle having Him with us because He is so different from us. So to the extent that we model Christ, to that same extent, we can expect to stand out and to be persecuted. So rejoice when you are persecuted, because this is a sign that you are on the right track. Now Christ takes this truth and develops it from verse 13 down to verse 16 in two metaphors. Firstly, the metaphor of salt. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything. It's to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. Now, what do we use salt for now? We can throw it on the sidewalks. It kind of melts the snow. I know people use it for cooking. The only thing I know how to use it for in cooking is when you put it in the water to boil so you make craft dinner. And I know they use it for cooking as well. You use it for flavor. You can use it for cleaning as well, I believe. But salt in the ancient Near East was used primarily as a preservative. Christ was addressing a culture where they had no electricity and thus no refrigerators. As a preservative, salt was used to slow the decaying process. Thus, as Christ develops this image, it is the purpose of the church to be a people who are in the world, but who are different from the world. A people who have a preserving effect on the world. Thus, if you can picture the world, the rest of the world then, as the opposite, as the enzymes or the maggots that are contributing to the putrefaction of morals in society and of the decaying of the image of God in the soul of man. But Christians are to slow that process. Remember the picture that we have had developed for us from Paul in Romans chapter 1. You remember the image that our pastor gave for us. It says the whole world is in a boat and rowing downstream in their sin, longing after their sin as they row with all their might towards the falls. But God, standing on the shore, has a rope attached to the boat holding on. And he is slowing it. But as his wrath is revealed against the ungodly world, he lets out the rope and lets out the rope and gives them over to their sin a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. But the Christians then, to develop that analogy, are those who are in the boat, who are rowing as hard as we can in the opposite direction back toward the shore and toward God. We row against the tide, against the masses, to preserve the decay of the world. And we do this in two ways. Firstly, we do it socially. Now, Christians can do this socially in many ways. We can do it by petitioning our governments. We can do it through creation of various organizations. We can do it through the writing of local politicians. We help the homeless, the poverty-stricken. When disaster strikes, we give generously to organizations like Samaritan's Purse or Compassion or World Vision or the like. Primarily, however, the thrust is on the personal level. So we do it first socially, and secondly, personally. Society, you see, cannot be changed by legislation. We do seek to preserve our society on a societal level, but we must understand that that will never ultimately produce the results that we desire. Society cannot be changed by legislation or by having prayers in schools or by anything the like. It's like I saw on the news a little while ago, they had developed this new nasal spray that you could take. And the nasal spray was supposed to function as an appetite suppressant so that people who were incredibly obese could take this and they would lose weight. Or there was also another drug I saw that they were developing where you could take it and it would relieve the alcoholic's drive for booze. So the alcoholic would take this drug and then he would no longer look for his alcohol. I am not the prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I do know this, that neither of those will work. For this reason, neither one of them addresses the heart issue, the longing for comfort and for solace and for whatever sinful desire it is in finding in food or in excessive alcohol. It's dealing on the surface. It's not getting to the heart of the issue. It's not pulling the weed up from the roots. We must take our cue, take an example from the revolution in England that was started by George Whitefield, that was carried on by the Wesleys, and all that would come after him. These men came to an English society that was downtrodden, that was just ultimately depraved. This was a society that was saturated by whiskey houses, by drinking, by slave trade, by animal and widespread human abuse. And they did not come preaching legislature. They came preaching Christ to the hearts of men. And as people's hearts were changed, society was changed as a result. It was changed not on a surface level, but from the inside out. You see, society was only as bad as it was because the hearts of individuals were as bad as they were. And the same is true today. Sometimes we hear people say, sometimes we even say ourselves, oh, what has this society come to? It's not society as its own entity, but the hearts of the individuals within society that have driven all of society to the place where it is. Thus, the gospel is the only answer to bring about change, to slow the decaying process in this world. And this is not the job of preachers only. There is a great emphasis throughout that movement in England on personal spirituality and piety. And I believe, along with John Piper, who wrote and said, we don't just need another Luther or another Augustine for our day, but what we need is tens of thousands of ordinary, everyday Christians like you and like me, who are absolutely consumed with a delight in God and in seeing His righteousness developed on earth and His kingdom advanced on earth, that we are dedicated to living for His glory and preaching His gospel, and in that way we will slow the decay of the society around us. Christ says that we are the salt of the earth. We're it. If the salt isn't working, in other words, if society is decaying, and we want to know why. Why are things going as bad as they are in the world around us? All you need to do is find a mirror. Because we are the salt. We are all that has been given to preserve this world. If society is decaying, it is because the salt is not functioning as it ought. And Jesus goes there himself. What is salt good for if it's lost its saltiness? Now, you have to understand, salt in a way can never really lose its saltiness. It is always salt. But it can lose its effectiveness as a preservative if it is effectively adulterated or diluted by the presence of other impure substances. When this has happened, and when the salt can no longer function as it ought to, there is no purpose, there is no use, there is no reason for that salt even to exist. Throw it out! Put it on the street! Trample on it! In the ancient Near East, that's the garbage dump. Throw it on the street! Let people walk on it! Who cares? It's good for nothing if it does not do this. Thus, the application comes. If you are not, as a Christian, living out the heart of the Beatitudes, if you are not, as a Christian, standing out and being different, if we, as a church of Christians, are not making an impact in the society around us, we're useless. We're no good. We're good for nothing. And Christ did not come. Christ did not teach. Christ did not die and rise again to create a church that was good for nothing, or a Christian that is good for nothing, because they were afraid to stand out and be different. Second metaphor is light. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Now this is, in at least in a certain sense, kind of lost its meaning for us who have grown up in Toronto or who live in metropolis. Because there's so much light pollution that we can't really even picture what Jesus is saying. But go back 2,000 years, again, to a world before electricity and to a world that is not developed in urban sprawl like we see now. Christ has the darkness of the wilderness in the pitch dark of night here in his mind. And in the ancient Near Eastern world, the smallest of torches on the top of a city wall would be visible for quite some distance, so that the wandering, weary traveler might find his way home. Or perhaps it could be useful for a band of raiders seeking for a night attack. But either way, you cannot escape the fact that the purpose of the light is so that it can be seen. Likewise, Jesus says, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but they put it on a stand. Now, if we hang lights like we do in the gym here, or else if you're driving along the highway, you see the lights that they put up. They don't put them down low on the ground, but they put them up high. For what purpose? That the light would diffuse as much as possible, and that it would shed as much light that we would be able to make as much as possible visible, because that's the very purpose of having the light. Doesn't make any sense to make a light and then to put it behind the piano. It doesn't compute. The purpose of lighting the lamp is to cast light on all who are in the house. There is a purpose to flipping on a light switch or to hanging a lamp. And so in this analogy, we cannot miss the fact that as when you have a purpose when you flip on a light switch, so here it is God who is lighting the lamp. And He has a purpose in lighting that lamp. He has a purpose in making you a light in the darkness. And it is so that we will cast light. And our casting light does two things. It functions in two ways. Firstly, as we cast light on the house or in the house, it exposes people's sins. Just like as we saw in the Beatitude, the purity of heart in one often exposes the impurity of heart in others. So we see that the presence of light exposes what is going on in the darkness. If you are in a dark room or a dark wilderness where there is no light, someone could steal, someone could murder, someone could do whatever type of evil they so desired, and no one would know, no one would see. But if we light a lamp, however, the person is caught, that one is exposed for what they are. And so we function as light in this way, and this is how the Apostle Paul develops the analogy a little bit in Ephesians chapter 5. You can flip over to Ephesians chapter 5. In verse 7, he begins and says, therefore, do not associate with them, for at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true, and try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. How do you do that? By being the light. For it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. So Paul says, function as light in such a way as you expose the sins of others and make them visible for what they are. Now, I used to work for a company here in Toronto, and we had to fill out timesheets every week for where we had worked, and we got a travel allowance. So for every different location that we went to, we had to write down on our timesheet that we went to a different location, and we would be given a certain amount of money for that travel. It became known to me that, you know, we worked in crews, so as a group we would have to go from site to site or from location to location. And it became known to me that those in my crew were writing at the beginning of each day and the end of each day that they had been to a place that they had not been. I didn't even know if the place really existed. I had never been there. So that they would have the travel allowance to compensate them for their trip into work and their trip home from work. Well, naturally, as one member on the crew, did not put those places on the timesheet, it would obviously raise a few eyebrows why the rest of the crew had those places on their work or on their timesheet. So they had to stop. Now, you can probably imagine what the reaction was to this. So when we function as light, we do not do it expecting necessarily a friendly response. Hey, thanks for pointing out my sin to me. That's great. Now I can work on that. But nonetheless, we do not fear them and we do not waffle. We don't hold back because we are light, and because Christ's commands are the basis for our standing out. And simply by living the Beatitudes, we expose sin. But secondly, we don't just expose sin, but we also cast light so that others know that there is a source of light. And imagine, if you will, living in a world where all you saw around you was darkness. And all you knew was darkness. And maybe you even had a torch, but you had no way of lighting it and no idea of knowing how it could be lit. Then one day you see someone come who does have their lamp lit. And you say, "Whoa, where in the world did you get that? Where did that come from? What is this light that you have? What is your source?" And the truth is that there is a whole world out there who is living in darkness, holding their lamps, perhaps even wishing for something else. Wishing that they could know something other than the darkness, but they don't know the source. They don't know where to go. And so Jesus says, "We are the light, so that others can know there is a source and that we can point them there." What we've done in this case is we've created a desire for, and in essence, praise for God in other people who would not have known of Him otherwise had we not borne witness to Him. And when men see that you are light, though formerly they knew you and you were darkness, they say, "Hey, wait, maybe that can happen for me too." And so you elicit praise and you elicit glory for the one who has lit you, as it will. Now, we are not navel gazers as Christians, so caught up with how pretty our own little light is that we just sit here and look at our light and it's just for us to have this experience. But rather, that's the very opposite reason of why we were made light. Christian, you were made light for a reason, for an expressed purpose, and Jesus gives it. We are little lights, like John the Baptist was a little light. He came into the world and he wasn't the light, but he bore witness to the light. And Paul develops the image again in Philippians that we're little lights that shine in the darkness of the world. And again, as little lights, we function to bear witness to the big light. This brings out the theme again that our righteousness is patterned after Christ's righteousness. That our life is patterned after His. We bear witness to Him because we reflect Him. So what's the point of being salt? What's the point of being light? That we would bear witness to Him. That we would reflect Him. But ultimately, Jesus says this: in the same way, let your light shine before others, so that, causal statement, that they may see your good works, and here it is, give glory to your Father who is in heaven. The point of you being saved by grace, through faith alone, is not your happiness. It's not better relationships here on earth. It's not wealth. It's not anything else but to give glory to God who is our Father in heaven. Because He has done it all. He has taken us who were darkness and made us light. He has taken us who were maggots and made us salt. That we would have an impact in the world. That we would reflect Christ. That we would give glory and we would direct glory to God the Father who is in heaven. We're like a billboard that the advertiser makes and he puts it right in the middle of the street that it can't be missed. It stands out by its very being and by its very nature. And the point of the billboard isn't that people would say, "Oh, wow, look at the billboard," but that people would see it. And they would say, "Oh, that makes me long for what that is advertising." The point is not us. The point is not to make us lights, but that as lights we would function to direct people to God the Father. That He would receive the glory. We must get it through our Western heads that something is not wrong when we suffer persecution, but something is wrong when we are not standing out and when persecution does not come. There is no contrast more clear. There is no contrast more defined, more unmistakable than the contrast of light and darkness. And that in itself is the point. There is nothing more different than the Christian from the world. So that brings us to a choice. Now, there's a motif that runs through, a bit of a pattern that runs through the Sermon on the Mount, and ultimately it builds to its climax at the end, but it's introduced in a little way here. And that motif is this: you must choose one of two. Choose one. Be salt or be a maggot. Be light or be darkness. At the end of the sermon, he goes on in chapter 7 and verse 13. He says, "You enter by the narrow gate or you enter by the wide gate. You bear good fruit or bad fruit. You're a good tree or a bad tree. You claim at judgment, you claim either words or deeds. What is your claim? You build on the rock or you build on the sand." But the important thing that we must notice is that in each and every case, there are only two choices. And it is assumed that whether you make a choice consciously or not, whether you make a choice right now where you're sitting or you walk out of here not making a choice, you are in fact making a choice. If you have not gone out of here in poverty of spirit, begging Christ for forgiveness, that you may be His reflection, that you may be salt, that you might be light, then you go out of here contributing to the putrefaction of morals and the image of God in man. If you have not chosen to be light, you are darkness. Jesus Himself developed this: those who aren't for me are against me. There's only two choices. If you have not chosen to build your house, that is your life, your way of living, on the rock, which is Christ's words, then you are just building on sand. Your house will fall down because the storm will come. And you will be swept away. There are over 150,000 people from Southeast Asia who thought they had more time than they did to choose where they would build their house before the storm floods came. Don't wait, because waiting is choosing darkness. Start at the beginning. Come in poverty of spirit. Acknowledge your sinfulness and your need. And Christ welcomes all who come. Value brokenness. Come to the foot of the cross. And live humbly before men. Beg for forgiveness. Long for and model mercy. Christ will turn away none that come, because He is the rock and His foundation is sure, and built on Him we will stand. Let's pray.